with U.S. foreign policy most famously taking several trips to Baghdad to meet with Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein on behalf of the Reagan administration, even as Iraq used chemical weapons during the Iran-Iraq war. And Rumsfeld returned to the War Department with the election of President George W. Bush. With many of the Team B personnel back in power, it should have been expected that the case for war with Iraq would consist of similar delirious falsehoods, and it did. Rumsfeld himself lied in a particularly jarring way in a late 2002 interview. He said, "The only way Iraqi weapons of mass destruction will ever be found, in my view, effectively, is if you find people who have been involved in it who are willing to come and talk to you about it and tell you where they are." The last time the inspectors were in, that's how it happened. The two sons-in-laws of Saddam Hussein defected, went into Jordan, and the word came out, and they told where these inspectors could go look. They went and looked, and they found weapons of mass destruction. In reality, two sons-in-law of Saddam did, in fact, defect to Jordan in 1995. Soon afterward, Iraq turned over a hidden cache of documents about its 1980s WMD programs, but no actual weapons. And one of the Iraqis, Hossein Kamel, who had run the programs for his father-in-law, specifically said to the United Nations, the CIA, and even on CNN that Iraq no longer had any WMDs. This, of course, turned out to be completely true. Thus, the lesson of Rumsfeld's tale was exactly the opposite of what he claimed. Iraq could successfully hide pieces of paper from inspectors, but that was it. Later, in Rumsfeld's memoir, Known and the Unknown, he would claim that the U.S. was effectively right about the WMD issue. John Nixon, a CIA analyst who interrogated Saddam after he was captured, he said he was motivated by the gibberish in books like Rumsfeld's to write his own to set the record straight. Rumsfeld's record on other issues during the Bush years was much the same. He approved a memo delineating which methods of torture of prisoners would be permissible while asking why the military would only make them stand for 4 hours at a time, given that I stand for 8 to 10 hours a day. In retirement, Rumsfeld spent time at his antebellum vacation home in Chesapeake Bay in Maryland. Appropriately, it was nicknamed Mount Misery and had once been owned by a specialist in breaking disobedient slaves. Frederick Douglass was sent there at the age of 16 for punishment and later wrote, "I was completely wrecked, changed, and bewildered, goaded almost to madness. And now Rumsfeld is gone." In a statement, his family said history may remember him for his extraordinary accomplishments over 6 decades of public service, the integrity he brought to a life dedicated to country. This is likely true for establishment history. For instance, almost none of these details about Rumsfeld appeared in the obituary just published by the New York Times. But everyone else should remember who Rumsfeld truly was, and the kind of person you need to be to reach the summit of American power.
Face to Face. Hello everyone, I'm Yusuf Jalali and this is Face to Face. Saudi Arabia and a number of its regional allies, including the United Arab Emirates, waged a devastating war on Yemen in 2015. The onslaught is aimed at reinstating the ousted pro-Riyadh Yemeni president Abdurrabbuh Mansour Hadi back to power. Estimates show that the war has so far claimed the lives of more than 100,000 Yemeni people. To get a deeper insight, I'm sitting face-to-face with the Yemeni ambassador to Iran, Ibrahim Mohammed Al-Dainami. Welcome to the show. Well, what is Saudi Arabia looking for in Yemen?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Bidayah urahibukum wa bita'damukum.
In the name of God, the Almighty, Most Merciful, thank you for having me in our embassy in Tehran, and we thank you for being with us. Concerning what does Saudi Arabia want from Yemen, as all know, Saudi Arabia wants Yemen to be divided, they want to be weak. This is, unfortunately, the Saudi kingdom is a bad neighbor. We're talking about more than 100 years of Yemeni-Saudi conflict. For the last 100 years, they've been trying to interfere in our internal affairs. And in the history, in the last recently, this has to do, unfortunately, with very much suffering. It has enforced too much suffering on the Yemeni people. The Saudis and who stand with it, and this aggression against Yemen, it's only to have hegemony and superiority over Yemen, and everything that they've done in the last few years, what we have done in our resistance against this aggression is to have sovereignty for Yemen, and the Saudis are trying very strongly to try to have control over Yemen and to and weaken its dignity and its sovereignty. We are also, they want to decide who becomes the president of Yemen and who is not the president of Yemen. Even the mayors and the governors and so on, they want to decide. They have always been decisions made by the Saudis, and even in the institutions which were supported by Saudi Arabia. We can see how weak they are. After this aggression specifically, we saw that there were dreams that they wanted to enforce, but they saw that the Yemeni people were very
the
much resilient and they were very much steadfast
into
in the
waging
face of
the
all
war
these,
against Yemen
this aggression.
Was to return Abdurrabbuh Mansour Hadi back to power. What is so special about Mansour Hadi?
Abdurrabbuh Mansour Hadi, الرئيس المستقيل والمنتهي ولاية والذي تم حلوله من قبل الشعب اليمني والذي
صعد the one whose campaign has ended and his term has ended, and he went as a president. He went into elections where there was only one candidate, that was Mansour Hadi, through this so-called initiative of the Persian Gulf initiative, and he is the main manifestation of everything that we are talking about, of the control against of Yemen, which was enforced upon them, what they wanted in Sana'a, this Yemeni government. And, for example, 2014, when there was an uprising for the people, the Saudis wanted to bring back their hegemony and their support, superiority over Yemen, their control over Yemen through this issue. He was the one who was in the face of this aggression, and he was taken as a pretext in order to launch this aggression, and it was mainly, and he said he had nothing to do with this aggression. He never heard about the fact that there would be an aggression in 2015, and he would not allow this aggression, and that he said that through media. What he considered this as another catastrophe for the Yemeni people. They wanted to continue to collaborate with this president.
Has been the major counterforce in Yemen that has stood against the Saudi aggression against your country. Initially, the movement fought with very limited arms arsenal, but now it has sophisticated weapons, including drones and missiles, and is really inflicting heavy losses against Saudi Arabia. I'm curious to know how this progress has been made there.
As you know, this huge aggression that was committed against Yemen, which has used all capabilities against Yemen, and the Yemeni people are a very dignified people, and they will not surrender to this aggression, and they will face and confront this aggression. And thank God we have the strength and the capabilities of the Yemeni army and the popular forces of Yemen. They were ready to prepare and ready themselves and arm themselves. And this is well known. The Yemeni army already had arms. This is well known and was sold in the markets. And there is a means for us to get these arms, and the Yemeni army was one of the biggest armies that was there in the Cold War, and even one part of Yemen was in the socialist side, and they were also linked, another side was linked to the Western campaign, and there was two different schools of thought, the Western and the Eastern, and the popular forces, what they did in the change of this ideology of the army of Yemen and the military forces of Yemen were able to defeat the U.S. Projects in Yemen. Of course, this is when we need something we need to create and build, and this is what happened when they saw that this aggression was launched upon them. They had many expertise that were used, and thank God now we even create unmanned airplanes, and this is something that we see that was witnessed by the enemy before the friend, that the military army was able to face an international war against it and show that the many armies that were very strong and superior were still this Yemeni army with the people of Yemen, and the fighters were able to face this issue. Here we're on the seventh year of this aggression, and the Yemeni people with God's faith, and thank God we were able to face this aggression. Of course, with all the enemies that we have arms from Russia and China also as well, and the Yemeni people. The Yemeni army also had armament as well.
Where does Iran stand in the Yemeni-Saudi conflict, and what is the relationship between Iran and Ansarullah movement in Yemen?
The relationship between with the Islamic Republic of Iran and Ansarullah in Yemen, it's not just with Ansarullah in Yemen. This is a very strong relationship and ties between the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the government of Yemen. This is a new revolutionary thought that was there, that was present with Yemen, and there were also different envoys, diplomatic envoys to both countries, and Iran was also there to serve and help the Yemeni people. The Islamic Republic of Iran is the only and main country that stood with the Yemeni people and spoke against the aggression and called on lifting the sanctions against the people of Yemen and was insisting on speaking for the Yemeni people. The media, of course, and also in the Islamic Republic of Iran, also spoke towards the international public opinion about this aggression and the need to lift this choking sanctions against the Yemeni people. The support also for the military forces in Lebanon, also in Yemen, and the support and diplomatic support for Yemen was also very evident, as many countries stood silent in this aggression, and they spoke upon the fact neighbors should be good neighbors with each other, and that anyone who is an aggressor, launches an aggression against the Yemeni people, is with the U.S. and with its hegemony, and those who stand with
since
Yemen
February,
with
the
Yemeni Islam
forces
and with
have been
the
trying
nation.
To liberate Ma'rib, the last northern stronghold of the Saudi-backed militants and an oil-rich region there. How close are you to a full liberation there?
In reality, everyone should know, the viewers should understand, the dear viewers should know that the Ma'rib, that area, was also a launching ground for the enemy and the aggressions, and it had transformed into a post, a military post for the aggressive forces, for the Saudis and the Emirates and the Sudanese. and even the American experts that were there working to lead and monitor this aggression. Of course, we have called on the United Nations to keep Ma'rib aside and in order to keep the people of Yemen safe. This is the main district in Yemen, which has very rich in resources, because Ma'rib also gives electricity to other sectors and districts in Yemen. But they transformed this into a conflict, and the United Nations has called on marginalizing this area, but the enemy continued to launch its campaign, a military campaign against Sana'a and other areas. The Yemeni people had to launch a retaliation, an offensive against the posts in that area in order to liberate Baida and Jouf, and they have also liberated so many areas and certain small areas and municipalities in Ma'rib. You have around four districts or areas that were liberated within Ma'rib. This was the plan from the beginning, and they were liberated as planned. And now we want to liberate all of Ma'rib in order to bring it back to the nation, to its country, and to also liberate it from Daesh and Al-Qaeda. And we need, and of course, the military forces and the popular forces fight side by side the aggressive forces, and they know where the Al-Qaeda is, where Daesh is, and anyone who fights with Saida, with Saudi Arabia, and the mercenaries
talks,
will be fought.
The Yemeni peace talks, of course, have been ongoing since 2018. What are the major sticking points, and have there been any headways so far?
In reality, the negotiations that are being mediated by the United Nations have more than one round of talks. We had two times in Geneva, and we also had two different talks in Kuwait and in Oman. We also have so many. We have other talks in Sweden to talk about several files related to humanitarian issues and to talk about the issue of certain districts inside Yemen. But United Nations unfortunately moved aside from what is right when they did not translate issues in the right way. They considered the conflict a Yemeni-Yemeni conflict, but they should have said from the beginning that it is an aggression against Yemen. It's a foreign aggression against Yemen. In reality, we believe that the negotiations that are being mediated by the United Nations will only be a failure. That will be the final attempt of these talks, and they are able to describe this aggression. This requires courage from the United Nations to speak about this aggression in the right way, and not to say that they need to stop this aggression against the people, and to say that this is an aggression from the Saudi Arabia and the Americans, and they need to lift the blockade against Yemen. They need to withdraw all foreign forces, the Saudi, the Emirates, and others, and leave the Yemenis on their own in order to have their talks inside Yemen, as they also have, as this Yemen has been an aggression from the Saudis, is an internal interference. These talks, we've tried to say these words to the United Nations. We have not reached any solution in this. We've not reached anything. So therefore, unfortunately, the United Nations, they were not dealing with the issue
the
in a logical way.
And has really turned into a war of attrition and is costing Riyadh huge money and casualties. Does this mean that Riyadh has failed to achieve its goals in Yemen?
What is truth is that our main aims is to stop this aggression. There are the main aims for the aggression, and there are even hidden aims. All the aims that they have set in order to they want to achieve in Yemen have failed very strongly, and specifically, there is no more a government for the president, Abdel Hadi Mansour, and they will not able to create any infliction of upon the Yemeni forces, and they wanted to break the will of the Yemeni people. But if we were talking about killing the Yemenis, about tens of thousands, or destroying the infrastructure of Yemen, they succeeded in that. There are also tens of thousands of wounded. Tens of thousands of homes were destroyed, and there were also losses on the central bank. There are also many people who are in famine, and there's so much hunger and famine in the country. This is what Saudi Arabia succeeded in very strongly. But anything else, they failed, a very heavy loss. They only wanted to enforce their hegemony, their political hegemony on the Yemeni people. They could not enforce this hegemony. They could not change the government in Yemen. They could not even try to incite the people and stop the people from facing the Zionist project. So the war against Yemen was the ladder that Mohammed bin Salman wanted in order to reach rule in Saudi Arabia. The objectives of Saudi Arabia are the result of its lack of reality and its illegitimate endeavor. And they need to stop this aggression and lift the sanctions in order to give the Yemeni people their will. Then we need to stop also any interference in internal issues.
The Saudi-led coalition on the part of Riyadh and on the part of Yemen, Ansarullah movement. So these are on the outside, the warring sides. But the United States has been fanning the flames of the conflict. We do know that Washington has made a bundle out of selling arms to Riyadh during the conflict. Is there all about economic gains, or is there a political dimension to it?
The United States and its role on the aggression against Yemen, we said from the first day, is a Saudi-U.S. aggression. This began in the capital of the United States in Washington at the time of President Obama, and at that time with Adel al-Jubayr, when then he was the foreign, he was ambassador to America. And from the first day of the aggression, the Saudi aggression against Yemen, they had support, logistics support, and intelligence support, and they had a big role to play in the support of the sanctions against Yemen, whether from the sea or the air or the land, and any sort of vetoes that were enforced on whether United Nations Security Council. Therefore, the role of the United States is the biggest and the most prominent role.
The Obama administration, it continued throughout the Trump administration, and now Joe Biden has promised, of course, to stop the U.S. aid to Riyadh in the war against Yemen. Has anything changed so far?
Actually, the American president, Joe Biden, the new president, has also taken this file, the Yemen file, and the aggression as an election card, something that he can use to try to change. He said he wanted a direct ending of the war on Yemen. He wanted to launch political talks. But after he won the elections, he lied to his electors, and he will still continue to support the sanctions and the blockade, and he did not fulfill his promise in stopping this aggression. Of course, we do not rely on the promises of the U.S. because it was the time of the Democrats that launched this war against Yemen. So Joe Biden's promises will not be understood, and even the so-called Gulf Initiative, or the American Initiative, they will not enforce any sort of hegemony on Yemen. That was also even before that was signed by Joe Biden himself. But when they also failed ethically, The U.S. failed ethically even through his electoral campaign that the United States will not fulfill the problems because it is the main partner in this aggression. They only wanted to try to mediate certain talks and to assist those who are Saudi Arabia and those who are launching this war against Yemen. And even there's the in, for example, the islands in Jayoun and Supatra, they are proof that the presence of the Americans there, and there shows that it is they are the ones.
Saudi Arabia has imposed sea and air blockade against Yemen that has kept the flow of food, medicine, and even humanitarian aid from reaching the desperate Yemeni people. I'm wondering how the Yemeni people can get their hands on the humanitarian supplies.
Also, dear brother, we cannot hide the fact that the sanctions is the other face of this aggression. There's one form of the aggression, which is the shelling and the bombing, but there is another form of this aggression, which is the sanctions, which has stopped the Yemeni and the medication and food from coming into Yemen and to the Yemenis. And here we're talking about thousands of people who are ill and need hospitalization. We're talking about people with chronic diseases, people who went to the Sana'a airport. We're not talking about one or two. We're talking about tens of thousands of wounded who could not leave the country in order to receive medicine and hospitalization outside the country. This has weakened the Yemeni people. This has shown the ugly face of the Americans and the Saudis who have enforced the sanctions against the Yemeni people. And people call on the international community to bring and allow the money to come in and the medicine and assistance to come into Yemen. Yemenis do not need assistance, but what they need is the lifting of these and sanctions, and we can bring in our own assistance, our own support. We do not want to call for assistance from any side, but what the international community needs to do is its duty to open the airports, to open the ports, and lift these sanctions. We do not need to call for assistance from them, but there's a catastrophe. There's a humanitarian catastrophe, and because it's closed, and this needs to stop, and allow the Yemeni people who also need this humanitarian, support in this. What we've seen is also that the humanitarian crisis, the United States,
United Nations says
more than 24
million
in the world.
People in Yemen are in dire need of humanitarian aid, including 10 million suffering from extreme levels of hunger. Tell us more about the humanitarian side effects of this Saudi-led coalition's aggression against your country and how grave the situation is for Yemen.
The humanitarian situation in Yemen is very grave. We're talking about a humanitarian catastrophe which has resulted from this aggression. We cannot come and have numbers specifically now because these are adding up on a daily basis. We see that on the first day there was a certain number. On the second day, we saw that the number was double in the casualties and so on. The people who had, for example, main parts and so on, and wounded. This is a suffering of more than $10 billion of losses on the Yemeni people, but this will not stop the Yemeni people from confronting this aggression, stopping this aggression in order to retrieve the political will and political determination, freedom for our people. And the people, the free people of the world, need to stand with the injustice against the Yemeni people, who stand against this injustice against the Yemeni people. This is our campaign, and this is our a national duty, and we see that we are with also the front of the resistance and Al-Quds and the resistance
Yemeni ambassador to Iran. All right, that's it for this edition of Face to Face. I'm Yusuf Jalali. See you next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, benefits of talking less. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. We know that Islam emphasizes and encourages the believers to talk less and act more. Now, what are the benefits of talking less? While there could be tons of benefits, we have selected for you five benefits for today's program that we are going to get across to you. The first one is acquiring wisdom. Wisdom can be gained through reflection on self and life. A wise person guards his tongue carefully, restrain it from leaking the secrets of others. Speaking unnecessary does exactly the opposite. According to Imam Ali alayhi salam, a wiser man is someone who talks less. Then the second benefit is achieving intellectualism. Talking less helps us achieve intellectualism. It helps us strengthen our intellect. A less talkative person gets a better chance at using his intellect more, and thus it results in enhanced intellectual capacity. Now, we all want to be known as wise, we want to be making wise decisions, and we want to be intellectuals, right? What is the way for that? Well, the way and the method Islam has prescribed is that we talk less. We talk less, we read more, we listen more, we learn more, we absorb more. All of that increases in our learning capacity. It increases in our wisdom. It increases our intellectualism. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the benefits of talking less. We know Islam has prescribed for us not to be excessive in talking. Now, two of the benefits of speaking or talking less have been mentioned before the break. Let's try to go over another three benefits that we have brought for you out of many other benefits. So the third one is uniting the community. In the modern era, we see disunity all around us. If you notice, one of the biggest causes of this disunity is excessive talkativeness. Those who talk too much often talk without thinking deeper, and hence they cause harm to the community in addition to offending others. Look around in your community centers, in your Islamic centers, in your masjids. You know, because of excessive talking, people generally end up creating confusion amongst the community. So one of the benefits of talking less is that you end up uniting the community, you end up keeping it together. The next benefit is guarding oneself. Your tongue will either become a blessing or a curse for you. It depends on how much you are able to control it. Many people get themselves in trouble just because they are unable to control their tongue. Don't just speak your mind. Filter it. Think. Contemplate. The last benefit we would like to mention today is softening of heart. We have a tradition where the infallible says, don't you talk much unless for dhikr of Allah, because much talking leads to indomitable heart and furthest human from Allah is the one with indomitable heart. And who are these people? Those who are unwilling to receive guidance. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Limelight. 14 years of brutal mass confinement, chronic malnutrition, trauma, psychological problems, and thousands of people maimed by weapons from land, sea, and air. These go on deepening Gaza's widespread depression and despair. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Muhammad Jihad Ismail, a Gaza resident and writer. This article is published under the heading, Palestinian Families Face Another Summer of Needless Suffering in Gaza. Here's more on the story. Muhammad Jihad Ismail, Gaza resident, and the writer of the article says, my family and I, my wife, our younger son, our elders, and the twin baby girls who will be born to us soon, ask the world to hear the conditions of our lives here in Deir al-Balah, after 14 years captivity in the world's largest toxic prison camp, and since the May waves of Israeli regime tank shells, artillery shells, rockets, and bombs have stopped exploding in our midst. In some ways, this calm is harder than open war. Right now, war continues in dispossessions of Palestinian residents from the neighborhoods of East Al-Quds. Here, most of the Gaza Strip's assets, infrastructure, and services are in catastrophic ruins. So there is almost no water feed for drinking, washing, or just cooling off in this season's volcanic record heat, no water that will not rot our teeth and ruin our stomachs, almost no water for the vegetable gardens that keep us barely alive. With luck, we have 8 hours of daily electricity even to pump it into household holding tanks. As May began Gaza's crucial fishing season, the Zionist regime banned boats altogether from the sea. Now that boats can venture at most 6 miles out or take fire from gunboats, their catches are as insufficient as the mere 200 daily trucks of other food allowed into the strip by the Israeli regime. 200 trucks divided by 2.5 million people, equivalent to 12,500 people supposedly fed by a single truck. Desperate for protein and nourishment, Gaza residents are forced to buy frozen fish from the trucks. This is often spoiled when it reaches Gazans. And what can a captive do? Complain? To whom? With any hope of a hearing? They hang on with raw courage and creativity. Palestinian and Egyptian bulldozers labor in the heat, clearing mountains of rubble from streets and crowded neighborhoods, filling in craters from bombs aimed to block crucial roads to hospitals. Last week, UNRWA professionals distributed food parcels, but somehow not including powdered milk, which might have replaced tanker trucks of milk so needed by young ones, but now forbidden them with no explanation by the Zionist regime. For all this, restrictions on trade and traffic in and out of Gaza are more severe than ever. Marketplace stalls are missing many important items, while other goods pile up unsold because people lack money to buy them. Workers and farmers lose the pittances they could earn, for their employers can scarcely get a hold of raw materials or export their products. Years of brutal mass confinement, chronic malnutrition, trauma, psychological problems, and thousands of people maimed by weapons from land, sea, and air. These go on deepening Gaza's widespread depression and despair. Muhammad Jihad Ismail says, "Yet, in the face of life itself grinding to a halt, we dream and work for a new, full, and fair elections. This week, we will celebrate the birth of our two daughters. And in both ways, we Palestinians will go on struggling for equality among our neighbors in accord with international law. In the face of so much needless human suffering, we ask the good people all over the world to reach out into action for true justice."
On June 24th, a 12-story building collapsed in Surfside, Florida, trapping dozens under the rubble. Search operations for the bodies of the victims have been underway since. Investigations are underway to establish the cause of the tragic incident. The building was built in 1981 and was undergoing a recertification process requiring repairs. A 2018 report by a consultant engineer had warned about major structural damage to the building. The incident, one of the U.S. worst in years, attracted the media's attention and has been making headlines for days. But there are other similarly or even more tragic accidents occurring around the country that aren't paid much attention to in the press. These include an average of 316 shootings that take place in the U.S., resulting in 106 deaths every day, or the reports on an average of 20 veterans are dying by suicide on a daily basis.
There's an issue here in terms of news coverage. But how do you deal with chronic issues of homelessness, of excess death, of death from the heat. I mean, in the Northwest, there have been several hundred people who have died as a result of the heat, the high temperatures up in Washington and Oregon and British Columbia. That's a huge story as well. More people died there than in Florida. And yet the Florida thing has sort of been the magnet for the media. And they really like, well, as there's a saying in the American press, if it bleeds, it leads. And Florida fits into that.
During the Independence Day weekend alone, at least 150 people were killed in more than 400 shootings across the country. U.S. President Joe Biden announced late last month that the Senate had struck a bipartisan agreement for a $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill to provide funding for the country's roads, bridges, the power grid, public transport, and internet. He, however, said the plan can't succeed unless a separate $6 trillion budget bill is passed. U.S. Republicans are openly opposed to the suggestion, arguing that the bill will create such a debt that can prove quite taxing on the U.S. economy. What there's a bipartisan consensus about is America's military spending, standing at roughly $700 billion. Between 2015 and 2020, U.S. military spending increased by 15%. The U.S. military budget is three times more than China and a whole order of magnitude larger than that of its arch rival, Russia. The military budget President Biden has called for represents a 0.4% cut compared to last year's spending. This has sparked criticism from Democrats and Republicans alike. That comes against the backdrop of the U.S. infrastructure that's outlived its usefulness.
A critical part of the industrial economy in the United States are military contracts. And so there is this sort of huge, sort of built-in bias to the military and the way in which it's discussed. Finally, the budget system here, which is obscure, I think, to almost everybody, including most people in this country, is divided into two parts. And the part that's called discretionary is the one where all of the stuff like the internet or infrastructure or highways, that's discretionary. Defense is treated separately and is treated as something that cannot be reduced within the budgetary framework.
Which one should be the priority, securing interests abroad or ensuring the immediate safety and security of the people inside the borders?
Since 1941, Americans have annually celebrated Independence Day on the 4th of July, a celebration that goes back to the 18th century, when American colonies declared their independence from the rule of Britain. That became the foundation stone of the modern United States, a colonial state which expanded from a group of British colonies on the Atlantic coast of North America by displacing and killing millions of Native Americans. The Declaration of Independence declared that all men are created equal, endowed to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But it seems these laws did not apply to Native Americans as well as African Americans. This 4th of July, the United States is grappled with a global pandemic. The U.S. is currently the worst hit nation by the coronavirus pandemic in terms of infections and fatalities. Also, the U.S. is experiencing an intense period of political and social unrest. On January 6th, a mob of then-President Donald Trump supporters stormed the Capitol while Congress was holding sessions to officially certify President Joe Biden's victory in the 2020 race. The attack left five people dead, including a Capitol police officer. Trump's critics said his incendiary remarks during his speech on the same day encouraged his supporters to storm Congress. Another issue that has plagued American society is racial discrimination and police brutality. According to various studies, African Americans are far more likely to be shot, arrested, and imprisoned by police than any other racial group. According to research and advocacy group Mapping Police Violence, nearly 7,800 people were killed by police in the United States from 2013 to 2020. Experts say the dramatic gap in police shootings and prison rates reflects biased policing, as well as the vast economic and educational inequalities that plague much of the country.
Because the United States has never, ever really come to grips with the racist foundations of the country, and it has never come to grips with the racist elements within the country that continue to this day.
This 4th of July, a new Yahoo News and YouGov poll showed that a majority of Americans believe everything about the United States is on the wane. 62% of Americans who responded to the survey said the U.S. is no longer the shining city on a hill. They feel the country is getting worse and are deeply divided over how to handle the coronavirus and protests sparked by the death of George Floyd. 49% of Americans said the U.S. response to the COVID-19 pandemic was worse than expected. Yet America's gloomy outlook goes beyond the pandemic. 64% of Americans say race relations, the focus of mass protests since George Floyd was killed by a Minneapolis police officer in late May, are also getting worse. Floyd's death sparked protests across the U.S. and globe that are a reminder of the oppression that people of color in the U.S. have always faced.
So, this whole idea of America being this shining city on the hill, that's mythology. And so what we should do is leave mythology to the Greeks. And we should try now to deal in reality. And the reality is that the United States sees itself as a unitary global hegemon, but what has now become a multipolar world. And Americans refuse to understand that reality. We are no longer the sole bully on the block. There are now other countries that are resisting America's sanctions regime, that can stand up to America's military might.
The once shining city on the hill was built upon the blood and sweat of Native American people and African slaves. 4th of July marks the dawn of a colonial system that came to existence by shedding the blood of millions of Native Americans and enslaving millions of Africans. The United States envoy to the U.S.-led anti-Daesh coalition has warned of a possible resurgence of the Takfiri terrorists in Iraq and Syria due to worsening poverty and inequity there. But what is the root cause of the instability and poverty afflicting Baghdad and Damascus? 2 years after the 9/11 incident, the U.S. invaded Iraq and opened a second major front in its so-called war on terror after invading Afghanistan. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence that took lives of over a million Iraqis and displaced over 9 million more. Consequently, the chaos resulted from the U.S. invasion eventually gave birth to Daesh terror group in 2014. 3 years after, the Takfiri group captured nearly one-third of Iraq's territory. However, Baghdad finally declared victory over the terrorists in December 2017. The victory was owed to the bravery of commanders Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis that played a decisive role in the full-scale fight against the Daesh terrorists. However, in a criminal and terrorist act, the U.S. killed these two figures in January 2020. That blatantly contradicts Washington's concern about the resurgence of Daesh. Following the assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, anti-U.S. sentiments escalated in Iraq. U.S. bases in the country have come under increasing rocket and drone attacks amid rising tensions over the continued American military presence in the Arab country. Elsewhere in Syria, the government has been grappled with foreign-backed militancy since March 2011. That later gave way to the presence of terrorist groups such as Daesh. Furthermore, over the past years, the U.S. has been leading a military coalition conducting airstrikes against purported targets of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group inside Syria without any authorization from the Damascus government. However, Numerous reports and official accounts have revealed the U.S. and Israel's involvement in the relocation of Daesh's elements across Syria and shipment of supplies to them. The U.S. has also been blamed for stealing and selling Syrian oil and other resources. While the U.S. claims it cares about Syrian civilians, it has imposed crippling economic sanctions on Syria that prevent the country from rebuilding after a decade of war.
It's really hard to be really clear about what's the motivation here, because it could just be stupidity. There's a lot of stupidity in U.S. foreign policy, pig-headedness. The CIA, when people say, why do you keep invading and destroying countries when it doesn't work, when it doesn't help you? And the answer that the CIA gives is, it's what we do. It's what we do. It's just that's the way we function. It's almost like it's an instinct to invade, to create chaos, to... So that's one possibility. Another one that's related to this is could just be sour grapes. It could be spoil sport, that the U.S. sees that these countries want to become independent, want to develop independently of the United States.
Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011 to topple the government of President Bashar Assad. After failing to do so through proxies and direct involvement, the U.S. government implemented additional sanctions on Syria through a law known as the CSAR Act. The crippling sanctions under the CSAR Act specifically target energy and construction sectors to prevent Syria from rebuilding after a decade of war. The CSAR Act enabled Washington to sanction any person involved in reconstruction efforts in government-controlled parts of Syria. The correlation between U.S. economic sanctions and the crisis in Syria is clear. Syria's currency has plummeted and prices for basic goods have soared as a result of the sanctions. According to the UN, 60% of Syrians lack access to sufficient food. Besides the economic embargo, the U.S. has also occupied oil fields in Syria's northeast, depriving Damascus of a vital resource. Moreover, the UN has warned that U.S. sanctions have hampered humanitarian aid deliveries in Syria.
Yes, they do want a certain amount of instability and chaos wherever their own interests are threatened. So Syria, it was clearly the strongest anti-imperialist, anti-American force, anti-Israel force in the Middle East.
Washington alerts that Daesh terrorists might start regaining territory in Iraq and Syria as a result of poverty and instability there. That's while the U.S. has targeted Baghdad and Damascus with crippling economic sanctions, which have worsened the socioeconomic conditions there. Besides sanctions, U.S. military intervention as a whole is responsible for the creation of Daesh terrorists. If the U.S. hadn't invaded Iraq in 2003, and if Washington and its allies hadn't backed opposition groups and al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, Daesh never would have formed.
The crisis in Yemen is deepening as fresh fierce clashes between Yemeni forces and Saudi-led militants have erupted in Ma'arib. The clashes happened between Yemeni forces and Allied Popular Committees fighters and the rival forces who are loyal to former President Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi. Local sources say the Yemeni troops and Allied Popular Committee fighters mounted intensive attacks from the north, south, and west to push the Saudi mercenaries out of the region. Saudi warplanes are reported to have conducted more than a dozen strikes in residential areas across the region.
Well, it clearly shows that the Ansarullah movement cannot be defeated. And that's what's so important, that Saudi Arabia, with all of its vast military equipment and years of U.S. support, military aid, jet aircraft, naval blockades, have failed to defeat the Ansarullah movement. And as a matter of fact, have suffered one defeat after another.
Over the past few weeks, Ma'arib has been the scene of large-scale operations by Yemeni troops and their allied forces. They're pushing against Saudi-sponsored pro-Hadi militants. Yemeni forces